Okay, I think we're taping again
Taping
now.
in.
Yeah.
So I really had to personally undergo a transition and learn a great deal more in different technologies within the technology than when I was with the GSE department. I have to say that S4B, for the most part, was essentially the follow-on to S4 technology-wise. Much of the same equipment, electronics equipment that flew on the S4 program were essentially flown on S4B with some minor modifications. So we had a lot of flight history and a lot of confidence when we went into the S4B program. The major changes were associated with a different engine, different control systems, and so on. But from a pure technology point of view, I have to say that we did our development a great deal on S4 and carried it over on S4B. That's not the case in the ground support equipment. And I'm sure Jerry probably elaborated on that. We went from a pure old-fashioned mechanical manual kind of design approach to a, at that time, a rather exotic computer control system that, in my opinion, was one of the first of its kind from a command response kind of system.
Was this pretty
Which
much a
was
unique Douglas concept and
yes.
design? Yeah.
And met, and I don't know, I don't want to preempt what Jerry said, but it met with some opposition, both internally and externally, because of a lack of confidence in this new world called computers, and the fact that to put yourself under the control of the computer to do certain critical operations, such as static firing and checkout, takes some courage and some confidence building. So what we did is design a through a simulator and through many, many software simulations and on-the-job training debugging exercises and whatnot, we had to build a lot of confidence into our own test people and to our management.
When you say external, you mean Marshall?
With the Marshall Space Flight Center.
Yeah, I hope this question isn't taken wrong, but this opposition, did this come from the old von Braun group? Maybe because they, as the early engineers, had that much less contact with computers, or did it come from people at Marshall who had been around computers and maybe should have known better, if I could use that phrase?
Well, I think mostly the former, because in all honesty, the technology that had been essentially practiced at Huntsville up until that time was fairly straightforward and in some ways antiquated, really.
Yeah, excuse me, I don't interrupt you at a time. This
Yeah.
is about 64 we're talking about
No,
now.
this is 63, 64.
Okay.
There had been, it's not that computers were completely unknown, but the computer technology at that time was pretty much relegated to guidance applications and to certain flight control systems. But other than that, and data and the pure old data processing, data reduction kind of usage, it was a new breakthrough, really. And you couple that with the fact that within industry, there was a somewhat different approach to how much manual versus automatic checkout you should use, how much really at the firing sites like North American, at Mississippi or Santa Susana or wherever the case might be, there was a difference within the industry conceptually, philosophically. So the whole checkout area and test area was quite a controversial subject in those days.
Yeah.
And of course that influenced the design in part too.
Mm-hmm.
Fault isolation, how far down you isolate faults in the equipment, and so on.
Well, through the simulators, you were able to convince people that this would really work?
Mostly internally, we were. And then after we got some experience during battleship firings and static firings at Sacramento, people really began to believe in the machine.
Mm-hmm.
And I would guess that eventually over a period of time that there's more togetherness throughout the throughout industry in that regard. But in all fairness, even today at the Cape, even though they have a different system, they use RCA 110 computers, but today for the last few launches is really, they're now at a point, just today, where Sacramento has been for years in automation,
mm-hmm.
full automation. In other words, they've evolved a program down at the Cape where they just slowly but surely walked into this automation thing, where they have now pretty much of a computer control system. Not completely as elaborate as Sacramento was, but it's near the the approach.
Mm-hmm. As program manager, were there things that just really gave you special fits and headaches, and were there things too that made you specially gratified and specially proud? I wonder if you could tell us about some of the ups and downs, really.
Well, I would have to say in the 8 months I've been in this particular assignment, there are probably two major challenges that we have. The first is one of retaining the proper skills, and when I say skills, I mean people and software, paper, if you will, required in a period of time where we're in this offloading and stretching out of the program.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fantastic challenge because of the budget considerations and the offloading of many key people after the Apollo 11. So what we've had to do internally make adjustments. We've had to design programs to retain our key people and work out mutual arrangements with NASA on personnel changes.
You consult with NASA before you?
Yes, we have a, it's not a contractual arrangement, but it's a an understanding, if you will, based on an agreed upon list of people, and these primarily are key management people and key technical people. We feel obligated to ourselves and to NASA to notify them if we make any changes of these particular people who have been singled out. Now this is a primarily result, Roger, of to go this far, as a result of the Apollo 13 incident and the fact that one of the findings that came out of the review was that it was general accord that within industry and within the government there had been, in their opinion, maybe a little bit of a mass exodus off the program after Apollo 11. So directives came down from NASA headquarters to the centers,
mm-hmm.
to, all right, let's get organized and make sure this doesn't happen again. You work out individually with your contractors some arrangement, and we have done that now.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is not unique to McDonnell Douglas, this is throughout industry. related to that is the fantastic problem we have at the launch site. Because of the stretch out, 6 months to 8 months launch centers, of keeping our people tuned up, the morale up, the tools sharp. We've had to design special simulations, on-the-job training. We've even gone to the point now of conducting written examinations before the launch. For each panel position. We even give medical exams now to our people to make sure they're emotionally okay, they can hear properly and within the audio range, they react normally. We're going to all kinds of things now that we used to think was not necessary because we now think it is necessary, and we have symptoms that say that it's a good thing because most of our problems nowadays are really human errors and perhaps misjudgments on their part, not design problems, really. We've solved most of the design problems.
Designs are pretty well stabilized.
Yeah, it's quality control, and that, again, is sort of human-oriented in a way. I'm convinced that no matter how good your flight history has been, and hell, we've had 100%, if you will, but the first thing I think I learned when I came in this job was that the only thing that really matters at the time you launch is how good that particular hardware is, not anything else. It's the serial number of the stage and all the parts on that stage that really matters. How good is it? The pedigree of that hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And you just don't live on your past laurels and test experience, what it amounts to. So you can't do enough about assuring yourself that particular piece is as good as you can make. So I think, in general, that's one of our it's a constant problem, to keep our the morale up of the people and their tools sharp enough to do the job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true back here, but it's more true at the launch site. Because there are so much diverse activities here, you can always find something to do and keep these people challenged. But out in the field, that's not the case. Now, again, that's not a unique problem to McDonnell Douglas. That's an industry problem.
Yeah.
I think the other, the other real challenge is one of trying to promote new schemes for extending the life of our S-4B. And here we get into the competitive world of how do we use up this residual hardware that obviously isn't planned to be used? How do we make the launch cost competitive with other vehicles?
Mm-hmm.
Other vehicles, primarily in the Air Force arsenal.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of survival, in part, for the manned space business. So what we are doing in conjunction with other people in industry, and this is an authorized study, is to look into new ways of handling the whole Saturn storage, retrieval, checkout, launch operations under an arrangement where perhaps we as one contractor or as a prime contractor can essentially manage the operations more effectively, more cost effectively.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what I'm saying is a single launch contract concept at the KSC. So we're helping the government as best we can prove that you can launch these big vehicles at reduced cost and compete with other missiles in the arsenal.
Mm-hmm.
Now Now that gets into then other applications of Saturn hardware, and we're very, very active on many configurations of that. So between those two things, this particular time in my job is devoted mainly to those two areas.
Mm-hmm. Well, getting back to this, say, utilization of existing hardware, I was wondering, was the electronics, the flight electronics for the S-4, for example, useful in a fairly direct relationship to the S-4B, or was the fact the S-4B had the restart capability, did that create new problems?
From an electronics point of view?
Yeah.
From an electronics point of view, I have to say that most of the technology for S-4 was pretty much related. For instance, the development of a propellant utilization system
mm-hmm.
for S-4 was almost directly related and applicable to the S-4B. The basic power distribution and control system was not too different, S-4, S-4B. Electrically and electronically, such things as going from 6 RL-10s to 1 J-2 engine really didn't complicate life too much electrically. As a matter of fact, it probably simplified it. The only exception to that is the fact that with such things as having to condition the J-2 engine for restart, meaning the inlet conditions of the engine had to be a certain temperature and pressure and so on. That necessitated the design of a rather exotic piece of electronics equipment. Exotic not so much in function but in design itself, because there never was you might say an off-the-shelf variety or any kind of device on the market that could do the job. And that is the what we call a chill-down inverter. It's essentially a device to convert DC into an AC to drive a chill-down pump. But the characteristics of the design, the power required, and the environments involved was indeed a real breakthrough. And our design was essentially utilized by other people on Saturn, namely North American on the S-2 stage.
Mm-hmm.
In a similar fashion, the electronics for the PU system, propellant utilization system on S-4B. Those concepts, that design was essentially applied then to the propellant utilization system for North American's S-2 stage, and we indeed were contracted to provide that for North America.
Mm-hmm.
So the technology that started maybe way back in S-4 in 1960, you can see an evolution here.
Mm-hmm.
S-4B and S-2.
Yeah, it's interesting to put the S-2 in the loop. No, I
yes.
Thought of that, yeah.
So, it's probably true to say that electrically, electronics, technology-wise, for the most part, S-4 was really the thing that broke the ground. On the stage, that's true. I said again at the GSC that is not the case.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved in flight hardware on the Thor, or was that GSC?
That was all GSC.
Yeah.
And there again, that the concept there was very, very similar to S-4, or conversely, I should say. It's a manual, very straightforward design, relay logic. Solid state design wasn't really popular in those days and really came into its own in the S4 time frame, but we didn't really utilize it too much until S4B. I think perhaps if I had to name one thing that was quite different, it was the growth of solid state electronics in the time frame when we were designing S4B. It was much easier and cheaper to utilize proven technology and so on S4, knowing the confidence that was there and was accepted with throughout industry and with the government. It's sort of that simple. We did not have the sales job on doing something wild and exotic on S4, because we use the same technology essentially that we've always been using and the government had always used. S4B was the first really breakthrough in that regard. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever use flat cable systems on S4 flight hardware?
Not on flight hardware. We had a program. In fact, we've been contracted several programs for flat cable development. Mm-hmm. But it's more oriented toward what could be done, not what was done. How could you use flat cable on S4 S4B? What kind of terminations are needed? What kind of connectors? What kind of distribution schemes? And flat cable as a technology is just now being accepted completely throughout the industry.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt in my mind if we were to get a follow-on contract that we would seriously consider using flat cable. Our testing program has shown us that.
Mm-hmm. In your development of flight electronics, did you go to subcontractors and suppliers, or how did you...
That's an interesting thing, Roger, because I think what happened to our company during that time frame was real interesting to us, because aerospace companies normally are not considered electronics companies, and the ones that are have subsidiaries or some special companies that are set up to do their work. Autonetics for North America. Aeroneutronics, Ford, and so on. McDonnell Douglas since the early Nike series did a rather vast amount of electrical electronics design, but it was pretty limited to ground support equipment and to essentially integration of procured hardware on the stage for the most part. When Thor was born, there was a somewhat of a break away from that kind of diehard philosophy, if you will, where more flight hardware was designed and built in-house.
Mm-hmm.
When Saturn S4 came about, there was another step. So that when S4B came into being, we had a situation where the government imposed common specs and common requirements as best they could up and down the stack. And indeed, in the electronics business, this meant a great deal because the basic instrumentation schemes were common, which meant that the government actually furnished, as government furnished equipment, much of the telemetry system.
Mm-hmm.
Much of the control system, which might have been furnished by each contractor, and again was furnished by the government because of the commonality and the obvious benefits that come about by using common hardware up and down the stack. So that was probably the major constraint, not one of not having the technical capability or resources in-house to do it. But in general, we designed and built literally everything that we thought we could in-house electronically, that we thought we had the proper skills and technology, not just engineering, but I mean manufacturing and so on. So we went through the make and buy process internally and tried to design and build as much in-house as we could. Now, I'm saying that from a vehicle electronics point of view, because there never was a doubt about the ground support electronics capability in-house. Because we've done, even though S4B was radically different, the peripheral equipment and the interfacing equipment wasn't that exotic, and we had done comparable things before. So what I'm trying to say is that there was an evolution going way back to when we first became in the missile business to what we have now, an attitude change within the company, and feeling probably outside and inside both that we can do electronics work in-house.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the capability, both manufacturing-wise and engineering-wise.
But you still have to do this within the limitations of government specs, which were the same for each company.
Basically the same.
North American then would have had its own in-house electronic, or they went outside? Do you know?
Well, it's a matter of degree, how much they went out versus how much they did in-house. I personally see a different level of make-or-buy kind of approach over mm-hmm. there. I see more of a procurement of electronics hardware there than I do here.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's substantiated by the fact that the chill-down inverters that I mentioned before that we designed, they buy from a vendor that essentially has our design, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The PU system.
Yeah.
They buy. It just so happens that's from us. So each contractor probably plays their game their own way. But the command module, not the S2 stage, but the command module, might be different, I don't know. But the S2 stage, I think it's fair to say they probably procure a lot more than they make in electronics business.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the government furnished the telemetry systems and the control systems.
Part of the control systems, namely what we call a switch selector, which is a device that converts the data from the computers in the instrument unit into a signal which can drive relays and control such things as valves or whatever the case might be. It's a buffer between the computers and the end items, and it's a quadredundant control system, solid-state logic device, which is really, as a device, is common. There's one of these things in each element of the stack. It's all common, and all you do is change the input-output parameters. Mm-hmm. But the government ends up, the government tried to end up furnishing as much of the common, you know, hardware as possible. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a good approach. It did influence the individual stage design, obviously,
mm-hmm.
and did, you know, did determine a great deal about how much each contractor did. And it complicated life in part because interface control drawings and things had to be established, perhaps a little more so, because we had an interface then with the government, and we had to unique installations, we had unique environments, we had to essentially qualify government-furnished equipment to stage applications, and every stage had their own individual different application. So what was good for S4B might not be good for S2 and vice versa. So the government was right in the middle of all this. Mm-hmm. And during the early qualification times,